Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. In or around April of 1285, five Muslim riders crossed the border of the Kingdom of Aragon. But rather than swords, they flourished letters of safe conduct and rode on mules, unarmed. When they reached the court of the Aragonese king, Peter II, he gave them lavish gifts and they agreed to enter into his service. This anecdote begins my guest Hussein Fancy's fascinating new book, The Mercenary Mediterranean. For these five Muslim warriors were far from unique. They were part of a unique class of warriors fighting for the Christian kings of Aragon, whom the kings regarded as a class of military slaves, but who regarded themselves as worshippers of Allah engaged in warfare against Christians, albeit in the service of a Christian. These self-conceptions, Fancy argues, help us understand much about the medieval Mediterranean that has often been obscured by our own modern misconceptions. Hussein Fancy is assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Michigan. The Mercenary Mediterranean, Sovereignty, Religion, and Violence in the Medieval Crown of Aragon is published by the University of Chicago Press, and even on Kindle, the zeros and ones of the digital bytes are red hot. It's very, very new. So, Hussein, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Al. I'm really honored to be here.
Well, I don't know about honor, but it's going to be a good time, I hope. This is a fascinating book, and it's. I hope that some of the listeners who might be put off by even the Kindle price tag, I just want to say that it could be worse. It could be published by the University of Cambridge.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and it's worth being read by a wider audience than just scholars. I have to say that. But let's hopefully they'll be convinced of that in the end of 40 minutes. Let's get some definitions, pronunciations, and explanations of key terms and places out of the way. These are in Catalan and in Arabic. So, first of all, what eventually becomes called jinete, how is that pronounced?
Jinete. Well, in Spanish, the word is jinete.
Jinete, right.
In Catalan, it would be jinete.
Jinete, okay.
And in the book, I use a sort of truncated form of the Latin J-E-N-E-T, Jeanette, and pronounce it as well.
Okay, so we'll pronounce that. We'll pronounce this as Jeanette.
Exactly.
This goes all the way eventually. That's a very strange paleographic study. Well, not paleographic. Etymological study. Thank you. Philological, etymological study of eventually becomes Jenny, a term for a horse, which is almost contemporary, isn't it? 1350, I think, or something like that?
Exactly right.
But that originally it means what? A jinete.
A jinete. A jinete means a Zenata Berber tribesman. It's a very large group of Berber people who live in North Africa, north of the Atlas Mountains or in the Atlas Mountains. And that's in essence it. What we believe to be true is that the word derives from the name of this tribe. What we haven't seemed to know is why. Why it ends up being the word for horseman in Spanish.
Mm-hmm. And so this becomes a word for what kind of horseman? Any kind of horseman is a jinete?
Eventually it becomes the generic word in modern Spanish for horseman, in Catalan as well. Jinete is simply what you would say for horseman. But the story itself is far more convoluted. It's far more complicated, and I trace it in the opening of the book. I make my way through Shakespeare and others, thinking about how this word has this unbelievable journey through our language.
But that's a fascinating essay in and of itself.
I had so much fun just writing the opening of the book, and it was a way, I think, to draw in a large group of readers, or a large group of readers who are interested in philology and art and art history. But the story is a complicated one, but the way I've pieced it together, using Arabic, Latin, and Catalan, is to tell readers that in the 13th century, it meant something very specific. It referred to soldiers who rode in a very specific fashion, used specific kinds of weapons, rode with short stirrups on saddles with low pommels, which were unique at this point, or relatively unique to the Iberian Peninsula in Europe.
Because a heavy armored horseman, what we call a knight, has a high pommel to keep that weight in the saddle. It has a low stirrup to support low down. That's to support the weight behind the lance is what's key there when they strike.
That's right. The medieval knight was anchored in his saddle. He didn't move.
Right.
He just sort of charged forward and hoped for the best.
Yeah.
And the jinete or the jinete, by contrast, was a very lightly armored soldier, wore no armor, in fact, in the 13th century or earlier, carried a lance, maybe a short sword, would throw it, would stand up while fighting. Mm-hmm. And the essential tactic of these soldiers was to charge and run away.
Mm-hmm.
I should say in both Arabic sources and in Latin sources from the 13th century and before, this is seen as a cowardly way of fighting. They were all in agreement that these were men who did not fight in the proper way.
So
nevertheless,
even Arabic sources regard them as cowards or cowardly?
Absolutely. Huh. So it was, you know, the fighting zahf in Arabic in a sort of rigid formation without turning your back on the enemy was considered noble and correct in the way in which the armies of Muhammad, for instance, fought.
Mm-hmm.
But this form of riding seemed to predominate in North Africa. Everyone seems to have relied on soldiers who fought this way. These Berber soldiers were particularly famous for the use of these fast horses and this raiding style.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it gets adopted and adapted by Christian Iberian soldiers as well. And it becomes so popular, in fact, that jinete or jinete simply becomes the word for the style of riding. And by the 15th century, it's dissolved its specificity altogether.
Mm-hmm.
It's so ubiquitous that it becomes the word simply for horsemen in modern Catalan and modern Castilian.
And this becomes the base of the style of border fighting.
Exactly, right.
We could even trace it up to the vaqueros of California were armed in much the same way, even during the Mexican-American War.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the conquistadors still bear this memory with them that the style of riding that they're employing in the conquest of the New World is drawn from barbarians or Berbers, as they like to call them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this, it remains in the consciousness of people right through the 16th century where it seems to be forgotten after that point.
Hmm. Now, here's a word that some people will be familiar with in the contemporary world, and it has a great deal of applicability and yet the same complexity in 1285. Mujahud.
Yeah, mujahidun or huza are the words that I use in the book. A holy warrior is a fair enough, if relatively inaccurate, translation. But these are men who are devoted to a particular religious military practice. The challenge of the book, or the question it puts forward, is, I suppose we'll get to this, but what's fascinating, or the central question that seems to drive the book, we'll return to this.
Mm-hmm.
The other word that I'm playing with or defining here is either huza, which means raider in Arabic,
mm-hmm.
or mujahid, or mujahidun, which means holy warrior.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly that means in this
exactly.
In
what
context?
Exactly that means. I don't take those as neutral terms, but terms that I need to put into a North African context or an Iberian context in the course of the book.
And of course, a change over time.
Exactly right.
So let's go first to a situation, the geopolitical, the social situation in the 13th century in Iberia, and really in the Western Mediterranean, which is going to be very foreign to people. Amazingly enough, there is no Spain, as we can think of it. Is instead at least, what, four or five, six different principalities of various
sorts? Exactly right, if not more.
And it has a lot more to do with, say, our conception of Italy at the time. Maybe not that bad, but still. And lo and behold, the growing superpower there is the Kingdom of Aragon, which is establishing a certain dominion over large parts of the Western Mediterranean. What's going on? How'd that happen? And what is the Almohad Caliphate?
Well, when when we think of Spain from the present, we tend to think of Castile, because Castile is the region of Spain that would come to dominate the language, come to dominate the culture. It's also the case that in Catalonia, in Aragon, during the period of Franco from the 30s to the 70s, much of Catalan Aragonese culture is suppressed. So in our contemporary understanding, memory, touristic kind of view of Spain, we don't see this part of the world much anymore. But before the 15th century, one of the largest, and certainly in terms of the Mediterranean, one of the most dominant regions in Spain was the Crown of Aragon. It was a rough assemblage of three or four states in northeastern Spain. And as you were saying, they stretched out into the Mediterranean. They controlled Corsica and Sicily. Men from the Crown of Aragon eventually found themselves in Greece. They found themselves in North Africa. They were extended all over the place. This region eventually becomes a Mediterranean superpower, as you said, a widely expansive empire. The other thing that's remarkable about it, and related to the fact that everyone thinks of Castile when they think of Spain, is that because the Crown of Aragon merges with Castile, the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabel in the 15th century leads to this. The records of the Crown of Aragon, the royal records themselves, are mostly left untouched. Whereas the Castilian records are destroyed, they're vulnerable to revolution, they're vulnerable to revolt. No one is rebelling against the Crown of Aragon after the 15th century because it doesn't exist anymore. So their records extend back to the 9th century.
Yeah.
The medieval Crown of Aragon has the second largest, I think, collection of medieval documentation in the world outside the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And
were they beautifully kept? Were they?
They're extremely well kept. Also, part of our story that we need to tell is that they're kept on paper, which is remarkable.
Really?
So we have millions of documents that are mostly unexamined between the period of the 30s and the 70s. Again, this period of suppression of Catalan culture, the archive itself is underappreciated. It's only since the 70s that people have been going into this archive to look at it seriously with modern historical eyes. At least European and American historians have been going in since the 70s, pulling out remarkable things.
There's still a lot to go.
There's no catalog. So in some sense, you're swimming. You walk into this very beautifully preserved archive, very modern, to discover you have no choice but to either swim the whole way through it, which is essentially what I did over the course of 3 years, or cherry-pick documents.
Yeah. But it's terrifying and exhilarating. It's
jumping
off the waterfall.
Exactly.
So the Kingdom of Aragon, it expands throughout the Western Mediterranean, and what is the Almohad Caliphate? Does that predate the expansion of Aragon, or what?
That's
is
exactly
it?
Right. So, if one was looking at the 12th century Mediterranean, and if the 13th century Mediterranean and the 14th century Mediterranean belongs to a great deal to the Crown of Aragon and its influence in the Mediterranean, the 12th century Mediterranean belongs to an Islamic dynasty, caliphate, known as the Almohadun, the Unitarians might be the best translation of the word Almohad.
That's an unfortunate translation.
But I think very accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
And around the 1120s, a Berber prophet or a Berber preacher called himself the Mahdi, the rightly guided one, started a revolution in the Atlas Mountains among a tribe of Berbers, not the Zenata, but another group, to bring about a new original monotheism. He preached mainly to Muslims, but also very clearly had his eye upon Christians and Jews as fellow monotheists who should all return to the original message that he was bringing, a kind of very stark and clear monotheism. His followers eventually established an expansive dynasty across North Africa. They dominate the Mediterranean region, and certainly the Western Mediterranean, right through the early 13th century. Hmm. And indeed, the expansion of the Crown of Aragon happens at the expense of the Almohads. As the Almohads decline in influence, the Aragonese come to take their place. One of the arguments of the book is there's a great deal more continuity than we might imagine between this Islamic caliphate and the political and religious ideas of the Crown of Aragon than we might imagine.
What if, we shouldn't spend too much time on this, but what is the nature of, he's obviously not in the line of the Prophet.
No.
Does he see himself, do Almohad see them? What's their relation to the rest of the historical Islamic faith?
I mean, right.
You're differentiating them to a certain extent. Huh?
They are very different, and I think that's what's striking about them. They do not see themselves as Shiis, who they are hostile against. They see themselves as renewers of an original Islamic faith, and I think they are out of sync to a great degree with the rest of the Islamic world, which makes them particularly fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Umar himself, the prophet or the Mahdi, who inspires this movement, sees himself as divinely guided. He preaches in the vernacular, which is fascinating. Mm. And as I said, he seems to see himself also speaking to Jews and Christians very directly. Often this period is written of as a period of Islamic oppression of Jews and Christians. I think more recently scholars have been starting to think of it as a period in which these particular Muslims were going through a Unitarian movement. In mm-hmm. essence, they were trying to rewrite Islam, Christianity, and Judaism into one religion,
mm-hmm.
Which changes the way we think about the way they treated religious others.
Yeah. So eventually the Kingdom of Aragon, it expands, as you say, against the Almohads. It takes the kingdom of, or the Principality of Valencia.
Exactly right.
To the south, adding to their Aragon its own collection of principalities.
Exactly.
And in the process, they start to use Jeannettes. And you've got, you have two questions, some questions that frame your book. And it's basic. The first of these is, how and why did the Aragonese kings rely on such men, not only to fight for them, but to protect them?
Right,
they use these guys as a sort of Praetorian Guard?
Exactly right.
Well, so what's the answer to that question then, Hussein Fancy? I mean, in 25 words or less.
Right.
Why would they use these, obviously, someone who seems to self-identify as their enemy?
Right. I mean, the first chapter of the book is devoted to identifying who these men are. Mm-hmm. You know, almost no one has written about this subject before. There have only been three articles written about the topic before, and it's quite striking because it's lying or hiding, I should say, in plain sight in these archives. There's quite a lot of material about them. What I show, I think, in the first chapter of the book, or what I think I reveal, which is remarkable or surprising, is that these men are mujahideen. The first Jeannettes are members of not Almohads, but they are members of a group that has risen up against the Almohads, overthrown them in North Africa, the Marinids.
Mm-hmm.
They are a kind of branch, let's say, an offshoot of the Marinids who've been exiled to the Iberian Peninsula for having tried to rebel against the Marinids and have been told to fight holy war, to protect the Nasrid rulers of Spain, of the sort of Islamic region of Iberia. And
I'm sorry to be so dense here, but are the Nasirids, are they part of the Almohad Caliphate, or are they?
They're not. They're another, you know, so after 12 or so, the Almohads start a steady decline, mm-hmm. and smaller groups come to replace them. So there are a variety of states that emerge in North Africa, each competing over the legacy of the Almohads, each claiming to be their legitimate successors.
Okay.
And then within Spain itself, we see a number of smaller states also emerge. One of these is the Nasrids.
Got it.
Who will go on to be the very last Islamic state standing in the Iberian Peninsula at the end of the 15th century. So they start in this period and carry through for another two or three centuries.
So these are rebels against the Almohads, and these are rebels of rebels.
Exactly.
It's confusing.
It's a very confusing story.
It's part of the greatness of it.
Yeah, and I think the political story is it's really complex, and I think telling it faithfully is hard. But
it is.
The essence of the problem for me, or the way I reduce it, or to put it simply at the end of the first chapter, is that on the one hand, we have these Christian kings, and on the other hand, we have these soldiers who have arrived in the Iberian Peninsula from North Africa, in essence, to perform holy war, to defend the Islamic frontier against the encroachment of Christians. Yet, even though it's we never find mention of this in Islamic sources, and we never find mention of this really in any Christian chronicles, but in the archives we do, these very same men, almost immediately, almost contemporaneously with their first arrival in the Iberian Peninsula, become the personal protectors of the Aragonese kings. And so that's the question that drives the book, is how in the world are Mujahideen, men who are self-proclaimed holy warriors, also in the employ of a Christian king, not just in his employ, but his personal protector.
So they act as his palace guard.
Exactly right.
How do they serve him on the battlefield? Do they serve him on the battlefield in Iberia, or do they serve him in Sicily and Sardinia and elsewhere?
It turns out they serve him everywhere.
Really?
And by and large, what we find them suppressing his own men. So these kings of the Crown of Aragon had a particularly fraught relationship with their own noblemen.
Yeah.
The kings themselves were very aggressive. They saw themselves as emperors. They saw themselves as sovereigns, monarchs, and their own noblemen were put off by this kind of ideology. And the Jeanettes became, in essence, the shock troops of these kings. They would send them into some of the most rebellious regions to put down rebellions. They would also send them off to fight the French, which is, in fact, the context in which they're first recruited. Mm-hmm. The king of the Crown of Aragon is facing a rebellion from his own men. He's also facing an external invasion by the French of his lands, and he sends two representatives to Granada to recruit Jeanettes in, I think it's 1282 or 1285, I can't remember when it is, I start the book. And that begins a sort of century-long alliance between these mujahideen, these Khuza, holy warriors, and the kings of the Crown of Aragon.
Now, this dynamic is not unheard of in the Middle Ages. Sometimes you can't trust your own people, so you hire mercenaries. This is what makes Switzerland great eventually in the end. They shock troops for all sorts of people who can't trust their own people. So there's a long tradition of this going into the Renaissance until really the creation of standing armies. But this is what the Christian kings find advantageous in a Jeanette. What does a Jeanette find advantageous in serving a Christian king other than the wealth and all the rest of that stuff, gifts that they get from them?
Exactly right. So on the one hand, there's financial remuneration. We know it. These soldiers are being paid to fight for these kings. They're also given extraordinary privileges to fight for these kings. They're allowed to raid his lands or to raid the lands of his enemies and take booty and captives from there. So we find them bringing back, for instance, Christian captives from French lands or Christian captives from Castilian lands and selling them.
Really? And this is part of their privilege allowed by the Christian king of Aragon.
Exactly. You can essentially continue what you've always been doing just against my enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So from the perspective of these soldiers, one of the things I argue in the last chapter of the book is that we should be open. We shouldn't be closed off to the idea that they saw their service to the Crown of Aragon as an extension of what they had always been doing. That as it was, in some sense, also an expression of jihad or identity as Khuza.
Mm-hmm.
And to think of them solely as pragmatists, to think of them solely as greedy mercenaries, let's say, reduces the story too much, reduces its complexity.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to that in just a moment. I want to sort of end with that because you're speaking a lot to our own contemporary engravings, the ways that the sort of things that we have so heavily marked upon our brains, we can't get rid of them.
Exactly.
Basically, our deep presuppositions. But before we circle back to that, you point out, now I don't have the chapter number in front of me, but you point out there's a long tradition of Christians fighting for Muslim rulers in the Mediterranean. What are some examples of that?
Well, this is the argument. I think this is chapter 4 of the book. what I do or what I argue is that we should look for the antecedents for the use of Muslim soldiers by Christian kings in a few places. One of them is Italy. One of them is Sicily in particular. And that seems the smoking gun. That seems the most likely point of influence. Sicilians are fleeing after the Angevin seizure of Sicily into the crown of Aragon. And in fact, it is one of the illegitimate grandchildren of Frederick II who is intimately involved in the first efforts to recruit the Jeannettes. So I trace the direct influence of this practice, of this idea that a Christian king could have Muslim protectors, back to the court of Frederick II, where indeed he also had Muslim protectors.
Right.
Muslim protectors that he spoke of as his slaves, which is another interesting question. Mm-hmm. But the other place to look for influence is North Africa. As you say, there's been a much longer tradition of using Christian soldiers in North Africa. Christians from the Iberian Peninsula have been crossing into North Africa and serving for sultans, or indeed the Almohads had Christian protectors and Christian mercenary companies under their rule, and they used them in much the same way the Aragonese would later. They used them to suppress rebellions. They used them to fight their enemies, and they never used them to fight other Christians. They had this sort of circumscribed use of them to protect their authority, but also a sense that there were limits to the use. These companies have extensive and very long history in North Africa. And over the course of the 13th century, one of the best set of sources that I found for the book are a series of Arabic charters that also lie in the Crown of Aragon archives in Barcelona, in which we see these soldiers, Christian soldiers and Muslim soldiers, traded for one another. We find Muslim rulers in North Africa exchanging their own soldiers, Jeannettes, for Christian heavy cavalry to use in their armies in North Africa, and agreeing at the same time to limits on how they will be used. So Christian kings will agree to take Muslim soldiers, but under the condition that they will only use them to fight Christians. Muslim rulers will take Christian soldiers, but only on the condition that they agree to use them only against Muslims. So these are some striking kinds of agreements that we haven't looked at before, thought about before as historians that I dig up. The tradition of using Christian soldiers in North Africa goes back even further, I think. It takes us back to the Abbasid period. The Abbasids themselves were recruiters of foreign soldiers, slave soldiers that they used in their armies. They borrowed this tradition from other groups like the Sassanids, pre-Islamic rulers, and the Romans, indeed, also had, as you insinuated earlier, they also had foreign slave-like soldiers that they used as their personal protectors and in their armies.
The Byzantines and the Varangian Guard, for example.
The Varangian Guard is another great example. All around the Mediterranean from the late antique period forward, this seems like a very common practice. And the book tries to link them all together, not to see the phenomenon in Iberia as unique or disconnected from what's happening in the Islamic world or what's happening in the Byzantine world, but in fact, in conversation with them. Fundamentally, what I think this conversation is about imperial rule, what a good emperor looks like, how a good emperor behaves, what kind of performance imperial authority has.
Excellent. We need to get back to that. We're running out of time, but we said we have so much to talk about here. The word slave is interesting. We're familiar with other sort of slave soldiers in the Mediterranean world, the Janissaries, the Mamelukes. I have always understood it. Janissaries had to convert to Islam. And these don't. But what does a slave soldier mean for Frederick II? What does it mean for Peter II of Aragon?
For me, ultimately, it's a figure of speech. It's a figure of law more than anything else. Okay. That it's a tradition. It's an echo of what the Romans did. It's an echo of what the Islamic caliphs did deliberately, but speaks more to the shape and the form of political authority in the 13th century which was expressed through jurisdiction more than anything else, that the language of law was the way in which 13th century rulers spoke. Jurisdiction itself has that sort of quality. The word has it. It's the speaking of the law. So the way they understood themselves as kings or sovereigns has everything to do with the way in which they drew or undrew the law. Slave in the sense that these men were perfect expressions of their own will and authority. Not slaves in fact, but slaves in theory. And that's I think, the distinction. They spoke of them as slaves. And we find in the rebellions of Christian noblemen against the kings of the Crown of Aragon in the 13th and 14th century, we find them very angry about their use, that is the Aragonese king's use of Jews and Muslims as privileged servants, as slaves who are somehow also intimates of the king and power brokers. And you know, across this period, this relationship, this intimacy between the king and his possessed, his treasure, which is his Muslims and his Jews, is a point of conflict between noblemen and kings. Noblemen, I think, who recognize that these men, Muslims and Jews, servants of the king, are expressions of his power, not objects.
So they are extensions of his will.
Exactly right.
Which is, of course, what his slaves always are.
Exactly right.
That's the nature of slavery, is to be subject to the will of someone else. And this, but
that's the ideal, right?
That's the, yeah, that is that. And this is what they are in that, in
right.
that way. So this gets us to the sovereignty question again. This expresses a personal sovereignty,
right?
And understanding this, what I'm hearing you say, Aragonese nobles object to an idea of sovereignty which excludes them.
Exactly right.
So you are one of the, how should we approach this question of sovereignty? I mean, where does this leave us in thinking about sovereignty in the Western Mediterranean, at least?
Right. It's a very kind of academically sexy idea topic right now to be talking about. It had a new kind of fashionable moment in political theory as well. Strong argument of the book about these debates about sovereignty, about the state of exception, is that they are in some sense legal fictions that are shared among Muslims, Christians, and indeed Jews in the late medieval Mediterranean. The other thing the book really wants to do, I think, other than showing that the way in which European ideas of political sovereignty are emerging is in this kind of interreligious context, is to show that the practice of power really differs from the rhetoric that these kings use, that the way that they use these soldiers, in fact, betrays something altogether different than the thought that they are their slaves or perfect extensions of their power. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the sort of more subtle pushbacks against the obsession with sovereignty as an explanatory concept.
Mm-hmm. We've touched on this a little bit, but how the nobles see these genets as a rejection of, what shall we say, a rejection of their role in the kingdom,
yeah.
I suppose.
Exactly.
They see that it's an insult, and you can easily take their point of why it would be.
Exactly.
What do other peoples, how do they, these genets are used, you had said earlier, to suppress people within the Aragon kingdom.
Right.
So how do people regard them? I would assume very badly. But,
right. And, you know, on every level, it's quite a uniform response on the part of Christians of rejection of these soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine, if you will, that your experience living on the frontier of the Crown of Aragon of Muslim soldiers has been as raiders, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you find these very same raiders arriving as agents of your own king. It's a startling kind of thought. And I think this was the experience for many people living on the frontier with Granada or the frontier with Castile in the late 13th and early 14th centuries, was a kind of shock and horror that their kings were using these soldiers. Not only that, but permitting these soldiers to bring Christian captives into their lands and sell them. And indeed, in the sort of what's lovely and amazing about the Crown of Aragon archives is that we can go down to this very kind of individual daily life of Aragonese Christians living on the frontier and how they interacted with the Jeannettes. And what we find is they would attack these soldiers whenever they could. They would raid their camps at night. They would kill them. They would steal from them. They would close their gates and prevent them from entering if they were coming by expecting hospitality. Mm-hmm. So in the sense that they were effective agents of the king, they absolutely weren't. They were sort of faced challenges at every level. Mm-hmm. That said, I may be painting this picture a little too bleakly and starkly. We also see some amazing collaborations between Christians, Muslims, and Jews in these companies of Jeannettes. So we will find Christian fighters alongside the Jeannettes. We'll find Jews in the mix. We will find, as the last chapter of the book tells you, we will find Crusader knights, Templars, fighting alongside the Jeannettes in battles and referring to them in glowing and praising mm-hmm. terms.
Which could happen in the Kingdom of Jerusalem, too, for that matter.
That's exactly right.
In the 12th century.
And I think what the book is pushing against is the broader tendency within the historiography on medieval Iberia to emphasize the amazing tolerance, which, again, is always written against a backdrop assumption that Muslims, Christians, and Jews can't get along. Therefore, it's quite remarkable that they do. There's something in my mind that's rather reductive. It sort of reinscribes the idea, let me put it this way, that when most people write about interactions between Christians, Muslims, and Jews in medieval Iberia, it's often cast as they got along despite the fact that they belonged to different religions.
Right. Or alternatively, and you touch on this several times in the book, an older idea, even dating back to Voltaire perhaps, that they got along by rejecting religious ideas, that these are all proto-rationalists, philosophes in the making.
Exactly, that the mercenary is somehow the modern man of all of that. Mm-hmm. He's a rationalist free thinker.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. What I really want to say, or what I really want to push in the book is, it's our duty, our job as historians to set aside any kind of preconception we might have and let the documents speak for themselves. And what I find here is a story that cannot be reduced to a story of either tolerance or intolerance or happy cohabitation. This isn't a kind of medieval secular paradise, nor is it one that is wholly determined by something we would call religion. And the challenge really has been to understand what religious and political authority looked like, felt like, and were expressed as in the 13th and 14th century. They are far different than what we might imagine.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, and that, I think, is a fantastic place to end. My guest has been Hussein Fancy. He's assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Michigan, and the book is The Mercenary Mediterranean. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and it's well worth a read. As I think you've heard, it has many interesting implications to our own time, although they are not there's not any sort of presentism or heavy-handed comparisons at work.
Thanks, Al. It was really a pleasure.
Okay, thanks you so much. For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.